keep it coming.
My name's Eric. I'm alcoholic. My sobriety date is February 6th of 2001. I have a home group and I have a sponsor, and I'm grateful to be here. Grateful to be back. Good to see you, Billy, and thanks for asking me to come out. And thanks for the travelers that came with me, the visitors from another area to come and hang out. We all had some food at Pig and Steak. I almost ate a full rack of ribs, so I'm going to try to hold it together up here. And if I fall, Luke has agreed to pull me off the floor, and he's going to finish my talk, actually. I'm really grateful to be sober and a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I didn't always feel that way. When I first got to AA, I thought this was the worst sentence I could ever get, you know, because I thought I was doomed to be bored for the rest of my life, never enjoy anything ever again, and learn some new hobbies that I would personally call lame, you know, and I play Twister on Friday nights with all the sober friends, you know, and or maybe become a professional shuffleboard player, you know, and I seriously could not picture anything without drinking. I was not excited about it. It terrified me, and because I got sober when I was 19, and you start thinking, what do 19-year-olds do, you know, and the people I was hanging out with, we were partying around the clock. It didn't matter what day it was, or Friday night or Saturday night. I partied no matter what time it was or what day it was. But even the normal people, you know, or the earth people got out there on Friday and Saturday nights. And I just felt like this is the loneliest existence I could ever experience. And I don't feel that way anymore. I feel quite different about it. And if you're new, I want to welcome you. I want to encourage you to get a sponsor and try the steps, because what they've done for me is made sobriety bearable, first of all, but also have provided the same outlet, the same feelings of getting drunk, like peace, confidence, hope. I mean, all the things I got when I was drunk, sobriety has provided them for me, you know, it just takes a lot longer. And it's a very different route, and it's not automatic, you know, like taking a drink is. Drinking was detrimental, obviously, that's why I'm here. It didn't go well for me, you know, or it did. It went real well, real quick, you know, however you want to look at it. So I just want to say we didn't read how it works, but we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start, you know. Get a sponsor, be honest. I love sobriety now, and I'll tell you a little bit about it. I'm supposed to tell you in a general way what it was like, what happened, or what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. I want to say one other thing. If you're new, I'm not a spokesman for Alcoholics Anonymous. Not everybody in this room has voted for me to be up here today and agrees with every single thing I'm about to say. You know, I hope you come back and you keep coming back until you hear your story. Because that's what happened for me. I grew up in Northern Virginia with three sisters and my grandparents and my mom all under the same roof. My dad was not around when I was a kid, and I hated him very early on. My mom told me he was an alcoholic, and that's why she divorced him. Now, I don't remember my father. In fact, years later down the road, someone had to give me a picture of my dad to know what he looked like. He was not around. He didn't call. There was nothing. And it made me feel different from very early on. But that's not why I'm alcoholic. By the way, I got three sisters who had the exact same scenario, and they drink pretty normally, you know. So if you're looking for a circumstance that creates alcoholism, I'm not the guy to give it to you, so I apologize for that. I'm alcoholic because what alcohol does for me. And I'll get to that, too. But I grew up in this house, and the only thing I liked to do was play sports. I wasn't like a guy who liked to study or go to school. In fact, I couldn't stand it. I did not like sitting in class and listening to someone try to teach me something. I never enjoyed it. And I got into trouble very early on. I started stealing. I set fires. You know what I mean? I just did a whole bunch of stuff. I started smoking cigarettes when I was 11. You know, like I started doing this stuff so quick, and like it was no surprise that I was going to take a drink, you know, to anybody. In fact, probably people thought I took a drink a lot earlier than I actually did because I was such a pain in the ass. But I got into trouble very quickly, and my mom sent me to a psychiatrist when I was 8, and because they didn't know what was wrong with me, and they wanted to figure it out. They put me on medicine very early on, trying to see if that would work or help, and that made me feel different, you know. And very early on, I could picture myself, I'd be at a red light, and a car would pull up, and I would think to myself, I'd rather be in the car with those people that I do not even know, because they just looked better or happier or different than how I felt and how I was and with the people I was with. And so what happened to me, and I do have to say, I am an alcoholic. I did take drugs also. And as a 14, 15, 16, 17-year-old, they were a lot easier for me to get my hands on. And I will say a couple things, but I want you to know that I am alcoholic through and through. And I do respect our traditions, but this is my story, you know, so this is what I have to offer. It's only my experience. I was hanging out, and we were in high school, and there are three close friends of mine, two close friends of mine, a third to become a close friend. And we were hanging out, and I said I was never going to drink. I was never going to do drugs. I did not want to be like my father. I remember saying that very early on. And these three friends said, "Hey, we're going to get high today." And I said, "What are you talking about?" And they said, "We bought some marijuana, and we're going to go smoke it." And I said, "Okay." You know, that's my resolve, right? There it is. I'm not going to do this. Okay. So we go, and they say, "You're first." And I have no clue what I'm doing. And nothing really happens to me that day. But the next day, we did it again. And we snuck out of my friend John's house. And we snuck through this high window out of the basement. And we got outside, and we're smoking pot. And I get the effect for sure. And I felt amazing. You know, and like it was kind of that moment, like, wow, what? Why was I so scared of this? You know what I mean? Like, because I felt so good, and I kind of just sat down in the snow, and my friends were like, "What are you doing?" And I'm just eating the snow, right? Because I'm thirsty, right? You know, but I'm also like, it's delicious, right? And my friends are like, "What are you doing?" And I was like, This snow is delicious, right? And they said, we have to go back inside. And I was like, I am good right here. And they're like, "No, we're going inside. If you don't go inside, we're all going to get in trouble. Our parents are going to find out. So we got to get back inside." And I was like, fine. So three of us we clear the window. Fourth guy is a little bit more heavy set. Should have went first or second, you know, and he cannot get in the window. He's like halfway in, halfway out, calling for help, and no one's helping. And we were just laughing. I mean, I laughed so hard, and I had such an amazing time. And parents weren't called. Nobody found out, no cops, no nothing. I knew, like in my head, like, this is something I want to do more often, you know. And then very shortly thereafter, I started drinking. I made my first drink by myself. I had a screwdriver. I don't know who drank screwdrivers in my family, but I made that. And then the next, I went and told a friend in high school, and he was like, "Hey, what's it called? You should try Jack and Coke." So I did that next. You know, my first couple drinks were alone. Now, I said I was never going to drink at all. Very shortly after I drank, I said I was never going to drink alone, and I'm already failing there. So I'm doing this, and then I get invited to this party with this from this girl who's in my class, but there's going to be all these upperclassmen there. And I got to tell you, I'm really nervous, because I am constantly thinking about how I compare to you, you know, how my clothes match up to yours, how you look so confident, and how I feel so insecure. Now, I could never say this at that time, you know, like I couldn't even describe this. This is all hindsight, you know, but like I felt so uncomfortable around people. And I was running that comparison. Am I better? Less, you know? And so I get invited to this party, and I'm planning on going. And I get there, and someone says, we don't have any booze. And I kind of dart my hand up and say, I can get us some booze. And so this guy gives me a ride, and I had already hidden a handle of Bacardi Light, out in the woods, you know, and I drank twice. I'm already hiding bottles, you know, and to give you an idea what effect that had on me, right? And so we go back to this party, and we walk through all the people, or not all the people, some of the people dancing, you know, to like a boombox in the middle of this room, and which I've never understood. You know, when I think of parties, I don't think of that. I think of partying and drinking and doing drugs and getting messed up. And we head up to this back porch, which turns out to be a regular spot for me, the back porch at any house. And so we go out there and we start taking shots. I've never taken shots, but I'm a guy that pretends that I have. So we start taking these shots, and I take 4 or 5 in about 2 minutes because, you know, I've done this before, and look at me. I know what I'm doing. And I'm, I don't know, 100 pounds. And I'm starting to feel it, and I say, why don't we share, you know, because I'm such a giver or something. Really, I just don't want another shot to happen right now because I don't want to get sick, you know. So I take a couple drags off this cigarette, and now I'm ready to go. Like, I got to get up, because I am sick. So I get up as calm and collective as I can. I walk through this house, and I find a bathroom. And it is, of course, occupied. You know, like when you really need it right then, you're not getting in. So I head upstairs hoping for another, and I did not find one. I found a walk-in closet, and I just let it rip all over the floor, you know, and I grabbed this dress off a hanger, wiped it up, you know, threw it. I had no clue how much worse that made matters until years down the road, you know, when you start doing your own dry cleaning, right? And dresses are not cheap. So I wake up outside, and I'm in between these two houses laying in this ground cover in the grass. I had no clue how long I'd been there, you know. I walk back in the party, and someone says, someone threw open Kat's mom's walk-in closet. And I said, oh, my God, that's so messed up, you know. And nobody knew it was me, and I'm certainly not copping to it. And I learned something that night. I learned that alcohol makes me 100% comfortable, you know. I actually had no clue how uncomfortable I really was until I achieved a level of comfort like that. I had none of that dialogue happening. I wasn't comparing. I didn't care what you thought of me anymore. I measured up, or I was a lot better. And I felt so good in my skin. It was reckless, you know. So I started drinking and doing drugs as often as I could. For about 3 weekends, I had a weekend warrior phase. And then I was doing it every day. I was 14. Or, I don't know, 15 at that time. I don't remember. And I started getting into, I started stealing money from my mom because I don't have a job, you know. So I started stealing money out of my mom's purse and out of my grandmother's purse. My grandmother also had a flowering business. I would steal money off the top of that. Sometimes there would be stacks of cash left around. I was stealing money out of the sister that was still in the house. I was stealing out of her purse. I just had no regard for kind of what my family had taught me and what I should be doing. I wasn't telling anybody what I was doing, but I went after it. I drank and did drugs with reckless abandon. Like, I did not even think about who I was harming or anything like that. Because I thought, hey, this is my body. I can make these decisions. I'm not an adult, but it doesn't matter. Like, this is what the other kids are doing. Now, there were other kids doing what I was doing, for sure. But I dropped all the friends I had because they weren't. And I made new ones with people that were. I changed everything about me, my dress, you know what I mean? I started going to school just to meet up with people that were getting messed up. I started skipping almost every day. I got caught in school with some paraphernalia. I got asked to leave that high school because I had 7 Fs in 7 classes. I mean, I was just killing it, you know, and my parents were so proud of me at that time. And, I completely changed as a person. And, I was not interested in ever going back to what I was doing before. It was just so boring. I felt like I'd finally been almost enlightened, you know, and, by finding drinking and doing drugs. And so my dad was also sending child support checks, and they would come in this specific envelope, and, I started to realize what envelope that was. And it was addressed to my mother, but the check was addressed to me. And so I would just grab that envelope and take that check straight to the bank and lie to the teller about why I was taking out $500 or $400. And we would just party. And I had a really good time doing that. But everything else suffered. Because that's how I am. When I start drinking, everything else falls by the wayside. Like, I can't even keep up with it, nor do I even care to keep up with it. You know, I wasn't, like, trying to keep up appearances, you know what I mean? I wasn't trying to do really any of that. I lied to my family a tremendous amount, and I used to take pride in the lies that I would create. I mean, it's just sick kind of stuff. But I did. And that was the only thing. You know, and I wanted to be the best at drinking. I wanted to be the best at rolling joints or blunts or whatever it was, or creating a bong out of anything. You know, like, I just wanted, like, I didn't care about anything anymore, except for that. And when you're like that, you don't, I mean, everything, it gets pretty obvious to everybody what you're about. And so I got sent to this other school down in D.C., I got in more trouble there, and we didn't have a cafeteria or a meal plan, so my mom would give me cash, and I would just pocket the cash and beg for food, and I would keep the money and spend it on booze and other things. I lost a lot of weight. It's a diet plan, you know, if you don't want to put that on paper and make some money off of it, you know, just don't eat. And my family got really worried about me because the way I looked. And I stole so much peace of mind from them because I snuck out every night, and my mom would sometimes wait up for me or couldn't sleep because I wasn't in the house and didn't know what was happening. I was a wreck to our family. And what happened is one day I woke up, my last drink, I don't even know if it was my last drink because... The weekends I really mixed up because I was really just trashed, and I was celebrating my 17th birthday, I believe, and I got one gift from my friends, which was a beer hat that held the cans, you know, and that's the only thing they got me. And my best friend called to say he wasn't probably going to make it to the party because he lost control of his car in the ice, and my birthday's in January, and I didn't even ask him if he was okay, like, on the phone. This is my best friend. I didn't even ask him if he was okay on the phone, and when he told me he couldn't come, I got really pissed, because he had beer. He was bringing beer, and I'm getting ready to hang up the phone, and he starts yelling into the phone, and I hear it as I'm hanging it up, and I pull it back to my ear, and I said, "What?" And he goes, "Can you come help me?" And I hesitated. I didn't say anything. And then he said, "I'll give you the beer for free." And I said, "We'll be there, you know?" And then I hang up the phone, and we go walk, and we go get this guy, and we get the beer. And And then I think that was my last drink, if I'm correct. And the next morning I woke up, and there were two guys in my room, old guys, like 35, 40, you know what I mean? And they said, "Get up, get dressed." I said, "Where are we going?" And they said, "We're taking you to a boarding school." And I said, "What?" And my mom had walked in for a second. She said one thing. I don't remember what it was. It was really early, like 4:30 in the morning. And these guys were escorts, you know, not the fun kind, you know. And my mom said one thing, and then she went and locked herself in her room while these complete strangers took me. And they put me in this car, and we drove 6 hours, and we drove to upstate New York. And they put me in this, what was a boarding school, but it had a lot of rehab aspects to it. They called it a therapeutic boarding school, and it was based on the 12 steps of AA and the four absolutes of the Ashworth movement, which were principles I was pretty familiar with at this point, you know. The way I was living, honesty, purity, unselfishness, and love were things that I was just practicing on the regular. And I got to this place, and there were people there that had shining faces and clear eyes and looked fairly comfortable in their skin. And there were plenty of staff that were AA members. But I was so miserable. Because I had no interest in staying sober, never crossed my mind that I was going to get sober. Never crossed my mind. And a lot of times I would sit in meetings years sober listening to people talk about all the methods they had tried to stop drinking. And I would feel very different because I was pedaled to the metal from the start. Every drink I took, I wanted to take, you know. I got pulled out of my environment, and I didn't even get to the stages where maybe you should not drink tonight, you know, or maybe you should just have one, you know. Like, people were telling me stuff, like, "You're an alcoholic," but, like, I didn't try all those methods, and I thought, I can't be an alcoholic, you know. But what happened is I got so uncomfortable there that I started following some of their rules, and I started going to meetings and relating in and listening to people's stories and listening to how they drank recklessly, listening to how they felt when they took a drink, what it provided for them, that liquid courage, or their skin finally fit, you know what I mean? Or they looked like, they finally felt like men looked, you know? I understood every single one of those definitions because that's what alcohol did for me. And all the stuff that they gave up to take a drink. And it became undeniable to me that, hey, if you're not an alcoholic, there's something seriously wrong with you. You know, because 6 months there, I couldn't stop thinking about drinking. I hadn't had a drink, and I was just dying on the inside. And they let me go home for a holiday with my mom for Christmas. So I went home, and I helped wrap presents. And he told me to be of service, and I helped wrap presents, and I washed dishes, and I set the table. And I did a whole bunch of stuff that I may partake in barely before, you know, but I would certainly let everybody know how upset I was that I was doing it, you know, or let them know how great I was that I'm helping and being a son in any manner at all. I got back to this place, and I got a 5-minute phone call with my mom. We got 2 5-minute phone calls a week, and she told me she was proud of me. And to be honest, I don't ever remember those words from my mother up to that point in my life. I don't remember her being proud. And to be honest, I had never done anything that she could be really proud of, you know. I'd love to tell you that's me beating myself up and self-deprecating, but that's the absolute truth, you know. I cannot think of really anything I had done for other people up to when I got sent to rehab. And it hit me like a ton of bricks when she said it, and I had to rush off the phone because I could not talk. And my eyes started to well up, and I started to cry. And it made a real impact on me. I was turning 18 in 3 weeks. Like I said, my birthday's in January, so I just had Christmas with my mom. I decided, prior to that, I'm going to leave when I'm 18. I don't care that you guys want me to be sober. You know, in fact, we had a family group with my grandmother and my grandfather and my mom and a staff member, and they basically told me how I did all this damage to the family, and this lasted hours, you know, and they all cried, I cried, and I didn't say anything until the end, and they asked me, what do you think about all this? And the only thing I said is, I'm leaving when I'm 18, and broke their hearts that moment, and so many times before that, but I know I did that moment for sure, and then they had to drive home 6 hours and think about that, you know, and, but I decided, hey, maybe I should give this thing a shot, you know, and maybe I should, because I knew if I left on bad terms and just walked down the road when I was 18, I was going to get drunk, absolutely. Like, I knew I would feel bad, I was going to drink, I was going to do whatever I could, and they also told me I wasn't welcome at their home, so I had no place to go. So those two things combined, maybe you should stay, you know, and so I decided to stay after my 18th birthday, and I left there with a high school diploma. And I scheduled myself to go to a college, and I got out of this place, and the day I was leaving, this guy's walking around to all the graduates saying, meeting makers make it. And I've come to understand that phrase very differently than the way I understood it that day. Like, I need to go to meetings to make it, and which is, I believe, absolutely true. I need to go to meetings to make it, but there's a lot more that I have to do beyond meetings. This is an absolute inside job. It isn't me just showing up somewhere and listening to people talk for an hour and then going home and kicking my dog, you know, and yelling at my family and stealing, whatever it is. Like, there is a lot of work that I have to do if I want to stay sober. And I have to change, you know. It says the same alcoholic will drink again. This guy in my home group used to say, change or your sobriety date will, you know, and I've always understood that, you know, because I've seen so many people not. So I got out of this place, and me and this guy start going to meetings. We're really into it. We're getting there at 8:29, you know, and leaving at 9:31, talking to tons of people, getting numbers, getting service. No, we didn't do anything. We did Blockbuster, you know, and I don't think I have to explain what Blockbuster is to anybody in this room. At my home group, I feel the need to let people know what that actually is, because it's a very weird concept to anybody who's born in the late 90s and stuff like that. They have no clue what I'm talking about. But we would rent movies, catch up on all the stuff we were in rehab, you know, we missed, you know, because I was there for 2 years, 23 months. Justin was there for 32, so if anybody's available to talk to him after the meeting, he could definitely use some help. We started going to meetings, and that's all we were doing. And I ended up going to college down in Norfolk, and I went to Old Dominion for 3 semesters. I got there. I was terrified. I went to a meeting, and I said, my name's Eric. I'm an alcoholic. I have no clue how to stay sober here. I'm new to the area. I've been in a rehab for 2 years, and I don't have a sponsor, and I really need some help. You share that in an AA meeting, you're going to get some help, you know, and this big, terrifying man walked up, also old, 36, you know, and he walks up. It's a good winter joke right there. I'm 34, by the way, so I got this guy comes up, and he looks a lot like Jesus. I mean, he's huge, right? And he's got this long hair and a beard, and he's an iron worker, but he's like Jesus has been in a gym for a long time. Like, he's strong and terrifying, and I'm scared of him. Like, he's telling me we're going to do this stuff, and I'm like, yeah, we're going to, because I don't want to know what happens when I say no, you know, and he has a pickup truck, and I got to say this, because I got to be honest, wherever I go, I don't like pickup trucks, and he would pick me up in it, and I didn't ever want to be in it, you know, and I'm sorry if you own a pickup truck, it's just my opinion, it's not a personal attack, so he's picking me up every day in college, and I'm terrified. I'm so scared that I'm going to drink because I'm getting invited to parties, and part of me really wants to go. I want to be a part of and get the college experience, right? And but I also know that I've already had a college experience. I've already had experiences beyond that, you know. And so, like, I'm going to the meetings, and I'm trying not to listen to my head. I'm trying to pray. They taught me to pray in rehab, and I never really believed in God. And the first prayers that I remember saying were for my father, who I hated, because this guy confronted me, and he said, he told me I was just like my father. And I gotta tell you that, like, I did not like that at all. And I felt like, who are you talking to? You know, because I didn't leave my family, but I was leaving my family. I was just earlier. I was gonna be the exact same man. And so it took me a little while to let go of pride and really look at that. But they asked me if I would pray for my dad, and I said, expletive no. I won't. And they said, what if you say, please God have mercy on my dad who I hate? And I felt like if I could say that last little clause, like I could do it. And that's how I started praying for my dad. And so I have this relationship with a higher power, and it's shaky to say the least. But I'm trying to do that. I'm trying not to listen to my head. And this guy's coming to pick me up. And all these college kids are looking at me like, who is this old man this guy's going to hang out with? And I felt like everybody thought this guy was my boyfriend. And, like, I'm, like, terrified. Like, I don't want them to think that, especially not her, you know. And, like, I'm dying on the inside. Dying. But he got me to meetings every night. He just came and picked me up every night and got me to meetings. So, wow, I did not expect that. So he brought me to meetings, and he got me plugged in. He told me to get some service because he had a good sponsor, you know. Who had a sponsor, you know, and so I started making coffee at this meeting. It was my home group, and I got a home group, you know, I started speaking at meetings because they were like, who's this young kid, you know, coming to these meetings? And I got a lot of flack from people who were older, to be honest. And it really discouraged me. Like it felt unwelcome at times in Alcoholics Anonymous. People saying things like, you're not going to make it, you know? And I got some friends who really gave me some good ammunition, and I was just waiting to lay one of these lines on them, you know. One of this guy kept telling me, I was like, he was like, dude, don't listen to those people, because it was killing me. And he told me to say to the next person that says that to you, you say, well, you know what, you better hope I stay sober, because if I don't, you're the first person I'm coming after. So I was just waiting. I was just like, say it. You know, because I'm just dying. I have no tools for recovery. I don't, like, feel comfortable in my skin. I feel awful. I'm just venomous, you know what I mean? And just trying to hang on. And I went home for a spring break, I ran into a guy I used to get drunk with. He was at a meeting, and he had 90 days. He told me that he was going to a party after. Do you want to come to a party? And I had learned, I was like, no, man, I don't. I said, thanks for the invite, but I don't go to parties. Like, I just knew I shouldn't be there. I had no legitimate reason to be there. And that's what it says in the book, right? We need a legitimate reason to be in those kind of situations, you know? And to be honest, I don't really decide the reason still to this day. I work with my sponsor, you know? If he says it's okay, then I feel it's okay, you know? He said, no, I'm going to a sober party. And I was baffled. I didn't even know what that meant, you know? If you've ever seen two rams collide, it's like those two words entering into my brain at the same time. Like, I had no understanding of what that even looked like. And that's where Twister came up, you know? Like a chess party, you know? Bridge. Maybe we would play bridge, you know? And so I was like, I called my mom. I called my mom and I said, Mom, this guy invited me to a sober party. I have no clue what that means, but I'm going to go check it out. If there's trouble, can you come get me? You know? And she's like, yeah, sure. And I go to the sober party, and there's all these people from my home group there. And this guy says to me, hey, his name is Jeremiah, and he tells me that if I give him a call the next day, he'll try to get me to this meeting called Midtown. And I was like, what time does it start? Like it matters. You know what I mean? I have no plans. You know what I mean? I just got on spring break. I'm home. And I find out the meeting's 90 minutes. And I was like, come on, dude. 90, like, every meeting is 1 hour. You know, why do you need to be special? You know, so I almost didn't go to the place that I've found comfort and solace and an unbelievable fellowship in sobriety for 15 years because it was 90 minutes. I mean, I'm just closed-minded like that. You know, I find any reason to not do something that you think is a good idea for me. You know, and so I call this guy. You know, the meeting starts at 8. I call him at like 6:30 or 7, you know, see if he's still available for a ride, you know, and he's already at the meeting, you know, like probably helping other people, you know, and he sends somebody else to bail me out because I'm a typical newcomer, wait till the last minute for a ride, you know, and did he really mean he was going to help me? Let me think about this for all day, you know, and so I this guy comes and picks me up. His name's Lewis, and I walk into this meeting, and it was terrifying then. It was in a church basement, big, big room, like a fellowship hall, and you had to walk down this really terrifying stairwell, and there were people on both sides smoking, you know, and they're just staring at you. You know, I did not feel welcome when I walked in there either, you know. It might be a common denominator there, by the way. So I walk in, and there's like 250 people, and I was blown away. I thought to myself, there's no way these people are sober. This is no way. This is like real. And I started coming and hanging out with these people because I was so attracted to them. And they were my age, or a lot of them were. And they reached out to me. This guy reached out to me and asked me what I was doing the next day. And people were like, what are you doing this week? You know, come hang out, you know, and I felt like, wow, okay. And I started going to meetings with these guys, and I met this other guy who really took an interest in me, and he was like, hey, I know a guy who knows people down in Norfolk. Let me get you some numbers, you know what I mean? Reach out to this person. He was, like, really trying to set me up to be successful so I could be okay living in a college dorm. And I really remembered that. And when I came up for the summer, when school was over, I asked that guy to be my sponsor when I was home. And I did the two sponsor dance for a little while. That's a mess. If you haven't tried it, I wouldn't. You know what I mean? And you just start pinning them against each other a little bit, you know? And they're like, well, this guy said this. I mean, I don't know what you think about that, but it's like, I guess it's like having two divorced parents, you know what I mean, that you can work, you know? So I was doing that a little, and then eventually I just kept the sponsor up in Northern Virginia, and I moved up there, and started going to meetings around there, and I did a fourth and fifth step with that guy, and took me about 3 hours to do it, and I had about 300 names, and of people, some of them I didn't even know their name, you know what I mean? It was just a guy dating that cheerleader, you know? Guy who didn't give me a head nod in the hallway, you know what I mean, when I gave him a head nod. You were on my list. I hated you, you know what I mean, and I was going to hate you forever. And this guy talks about Scott Redman, who passed away, circus speaker. He used to talk about, like, if he accidentally was nice to one of these people on his four-step prior to writing the four-step, he felt like he had to redouble his efforts to let them know that he still hated them, you know? And I really understand that. And I had so many fears, super short sex inventory, just throwing it out there. And a secrets list of things I was never going to tell anybody. And that's not in the book. Not really. But I'm so grateful I did it. My sponsor recommended it, and I did that. And I told this guy everything, and we talked about 6 and 7 a little. And after, a little while after, and then I wrote an A step, and then I did nothing, you know, because I'm like, I'm killing this AA thing, and I'm like so far through the steps already, like beyond halfway, you know, and I'm on step 8, really, and wrote this list, and to be honest, the A step helped me see who I really am, like who I can really be when what I want or what I'm trying to get is threatened. And I stepped on the toes of a lot of people, and I did so much damage with my family, and that's where I started to learn how much peace of mind I stole from my mom, you know, and my sister and my grandparents, and how I really made them feel. The money that I stole, I got to see, tally that up, you know, and like what I stole from stores, all these things. And my sponsor wanted me to make amends, so I started making amends. I went up for my cousin's graduation in Pittsburgh, and a lot of our family was going to be there, and I made amends to my grandparents, and they told me they didn't want the money back. I tallied or calculated that I owed them about $5,000, and the same for my mom, they did not want the money. They just wanted me to get a college degree, and then my mom did want the money, so that was that. Made amends to two of my sisters. The third, she wasn't there. So I kind of just kept going with that. I went back to a kid that I had beat on. Not for many years, but I had picked on him for many years. I beat him up a couple times. And he had a disability. And I was embarrassed of that, you know. But I had to tell this man, this is who I am. You know, this is what I did. This is what I do when I don't feel good. I pick on people that cannot defend themselves, you know. And now I don't treat people that way, you know. And now I stand up for somebody who needs to be stood up for, you know. But, like, this is what I did. I went to make amends to him because I remember leaving Thanksgiving and I made amends to my family and felt like on top of the world. And I drove right by his house and my stomach just sank. And I was like, oh, you have business right here. And I talked to my sponsor, and I started trying to track him down. His mom still lived there, but he didn't. I was trying to get in touch, and I was kept going by the house. Eventually I wrote a letter and taped it on the front of their garage. His mom called me, and she wouldn't tell me anything about her son. Because she told her son, when we got off the bus together, run home as fast as you can, and Eric can't get you. She was going to find out what I was interested in doing to talk to her son or meet with him in any way. So I went and talked to her and told her I was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and then I was sober X amount of years now and I did a lot of hurtful things to her son and I was trying to come back and make them right, you know, I didn't know what was wrong with me then, you know, I needed a drink a lot sooner than I actually took one. But I wanted to see if I could meet with her son and make things right. She said, okay. I went and took her son out for lunch got together with him and told him, you know, what I needed to say and asked what I could do to make things right. And he told me, this is great what you're doing right here. To be honest, I made that amends and I felt good, you know, but I didn't feel like, I still felt awful. They say we not live in the past and we won't regret it, you know what I mean? So I can be helpful to people who need help with that story, you know, and that experience. But, like, it'd be great if I could rub the record out. But I can't. It's there. That's the best I can do with that, specifically with him. And I'll tell you what happened, though, is when I started doing this stuff, the promises started to come true in my life. And I remember being at Giant in McLean, I was standing in this aisle, and his mom walked right past me, just the other direction, perpendicular, and I saw her, and my heart just started racing, like anxiety through the roof, and then I remembered that I made amends to her son, and it just slowed down, like a peace just washed over me, and I was like, wow. That's why we make amends. You know what I mean? Because I say in the first mode, I'm drinking. It's just going to happen. I've had a lot of loss in sobriety. I lost two brother-in-laws. They both overdosed. And I've had a lot of stuff happen, to be honest, stuff that I did not want to have on my experience. But I got into a lot of car accidents when I was new, started driving when I was 19, never drove a car. You know, I mean, the only time I drove, I think I was drunk. And so I had to learn in sobriety. I mean, everything that I thought I was going to do drinking, I pretty much tried to do sober. It was awful. Got suspended, you know what I mean? Just being an idiot, you know what I mean? I got sued for $1 million for a car accident, actually. And I won both times, whether it's the first time and then the appeal. But, like, a lot of stuff has happened. And I was able to graduate college, you know? I was able to hand that money to my grandparents back, even though and they said they didn't want it. I said, I graduated college. You got to take this money now. And paid my mom back. I found my dad after 18 years of no contact. And we have a relationship now, but it's not what I thought a father and son relationship was going to be or what I wanted. Because I pictured me and my dad throwing the ball in the yard or something like that, and that's not what it is. My dad is he cannot take care of himself, and he's got the onset of dementia, probably from alcoholism, and all he wants to do all the time is drink. Last time I saw him, I was down there. He lives right outside of Raleigh, and I was down there, I don't know, 2 or 3 months ago, and just stopping by, bring him some money. We smoke a cigar together. He inhales the entire thing because he wants any buzz he can get. That's just the honest truth. It's kind of funny to watch, though, because he's like, man, this thing is hard hitting. I'm smoking the same cigar, and I'm like, yeah, Dad, it is if you inhale every single drag, you know? And he's like, why don't we have a beer, you know? And I said, Dad, I don't drink. You know I don't drink. I said, I haven't had a drink in 15 years. And he's like, you don't want to have a drink with your own father. And I was like, Dad, if I take a drink, we're not going to have a relationship anymore. You know, bad things happen to me when I drink, you know. And he starts telling me he tried to get sober once, you know. And I was like, yeah. And he's like, I got almost a year. I said, well, what happened? And he said, it's probably one of the worst years of my life. And I was like, imagine that, you know, and I knew all about it, you know. And I started learning about my family, his side of the family. And apparently every male in my family, in that bloodline, is dying of alcoholism or died of it, you know. His father, he called him the daddy of drinkers. His brother, who I'm named after, got into a drunk driving accident, got brain damage from it, and developed schizophrenia, and then he swan-dived off a mental hospital off a fourth floor. His father's father was a bootlegger, and I mean, it just goes on and on. And I'm the only one in my family that talks to my dad. And I hated my dad. And it's all because of AA, you know? Like, I wouldn't have a relationship. My dad wouldn't have anybody if I wasn't sober, you know, and which is an amazing thing to think about, because, like I said, I redoubled my efforts to show people how much I hate them, you know, and here I am trying to do the best I can to work with this situation, and to be honest, it is terribly painful for me, because he does not call. I've made 4 phone calls in the last 3 months, or 2 months, or whatever it is. I haven't gotten a call back. I have to call him. I have to catch him, because I'm actions speak louder than words. I'm the only one who wants this relationship, you know, and it doesn't feel good to be on that side of it. But AA has given me the strength to do that, and my sponsor and my friends, and so that's an amazing thing. I want to close with a couple things. I was able to make amends to my grandparents, and to be honest, my grandfather was the dad I know, you know. He was there since I was a kid. He was there every day. And he taught me and kind of guided me and showed me what it was like to show up and provide for your family. I mean, he came from nothing. And here he is taking care of the entire family and or helping him and my grandmother. Let me give credit where it's due. And when he started having strokes, and his first stroke, he put him out real hard. And I went to the hospital every day for 30 days. He got better and a lot better. Back on his feet, you know what I mean? Talking, all that stuff. Like, he didn't get any of the palsy or anything like that. And I handed him that money, you know, because I knew I had to. I was like, because the biggest fear is stroking again, you know? And then about, I don't know, 9 months, a year later, he had a stroke that put him out. Like, he couldn't do anything anymore, and he was trapped in this hospital bed. And I started going there 3 times a week, hanging out with him. And we couldn't talk because he couldn't talk, but I was just there and hanging out with him and showing him pictures from my honeymoon and doing stuff like that. And I was just there, and I was just so grateful to be there. And when he passed, like, we were good. Like, there wasn't a question of, like, man, I wish I had done more. Like, I'd done everything, you know? And I'd been a good son or grandson for 12 years by then, or 11 years, or whenever exactly it happened. And we were good. And then my grandmother just lost her partner for 58 years. You know, she lives alone. And because of AA, it dawned on me, like, I got to do something, you know? And so I started having dinner with my grandmother every Tuesday night. And we would hang out. And at this time, I started going through a divorce. Great experience to go through, you know. And to be honest, I've never wanted to drink more in my life. It nearly got me. And I was just so glad that I was so involved in AA. All the men that I sponsor, all the training from my sponsor to go to meetings, like, I would have never made that. It nearly killed me. But I'm going there to my grandmother's and bringing her dinner, and like, we got to find stuff. We got to get creative to find stuff to talk about. You know what I mean? We grew up in very different times, you know, and she's talking to me about Obama and talking to me about asking me why my wife left every week I go there, which is, I always want to just keep rehashing that. And we watch Jeopardy every week, and, like, I get 3 answers right. And, like, she thinks I'm, like, running it, you know, and that I should be on the show. And we had a great time. And like, I got to be there for her. I was taking her to her her treatments and cancer and all that stuff and be involved. And I started downloading classical music, and we would drive, take these long drives through traffic, and just listen to classical music. And I did whatever I could to make her feel comfortable. So she got really sick, and also strokes. I've learned what's going to happen to me, by the way. So it's either that, or alcoholism, or strokes. You know what I mean? It's just the way it's going to be. And she got really sick and in the hospital, and I got to be there for her again. And she took her last breath, and I was there with my family. And her 2 sons come up and grab me, and we're all together, and they say, "You're the 3rd son she never had, because of AA, because I was able to be there and show up in a way that was never going to happen." And through the divorce, I started thinking about drinking so much, and I was like, it started to dawn on me with all the amends that I've done with my family, like, could I have been wrong? Because my head was telling me maybe I'm not an alcoholic, because I wanted to drink so bad. I just wanted relief, and it was just trying to knock down the idea of why I can't drink. And the best way to do that is from the bottom empirically, you know, and say, hey, if you're not an alcoholic, you certainly don't need to do this anymore. And it was just on me. And I started replaying these amends and these moments in my sobriety. And it started to make, like, could this all have been a big mistake? And the answer is absolutely not. You know, I was supposed to do everything that I was supposed to do. I was supposed to go through everything that I was supposed to go through, and nothing happens in God's world by mistake. You know, And what I do now is, and what I've done for years, is I try to carry a message. You know, I try to be there and get out of myself and be useful to the people around me. I try to help newcomers, you know, and I work with a lot of men in Alcoholics Anonymous, and they are a godsend for me, and I love them. And like, I have just unbelievable relationships because of AA. You know, don't get me wrong, everything is not perfect, you know. Like, I make mistakes every day. I'm still selfish and self-centered to the core. If I don't go to meetings or talk to my sponsor about my inventory, I'm going to start down that road where I'm starting to grab everything I can, and then I start thinking about drinking because I'm pushing everybody out of my life. I have the best friends in the world. I have the best friendships I could have ever had because of AA, because I can be there for them. I can act like a friend. I can empathize. I could never empathize with anyone because I never cared. I seriously did not care about you. Why would I? And AA has changed all of that for me. If you want what we have, they told me, do what we do, you know, get involved, get a sponsor, work with them, tell the truth, clean house, trust God, help others, you know, and I've been doing that stuff, and I've never thought to myself, I wish I had taken a drink yesterday, you know, like, I love my sobriety, last night I was at a wedding for a guy, a sponsor, or try to sponsor, let's just be honest, try to sponsor. He allows me to sponsor him as much as he wants, right, I'm at this wedding and I'm watching these two guys, that guy, but these two guys specifically and a couple other guys just dancing like complete idiots, you know what I mean? It was so dumb, but I felt so overwhelmed because AA has given me so much and I could appreciate it. I was laughing. I just love being sober. So if you're new, please keep coming back. Please keep coming back and do what we do in this book, it can work for you too. So, thanks.